Well, good morning and good afternoon, everyone, and I'd like to welcome you to yet another Brown Bag Lunch program. And as Black History Month is well underway at this point, it's particularly appropriate that we have Dr. Juan Bernard with us today. And as you'll be able to see by the screen, he's going to speak today on the subject of Black Nova Scotian women working in service, the invisible history. And you'll notice well that it indicates her current position for the year 2013. Dr. Bernard is a leading expert in the area of human rights. Her research has generally focused on bringing attention to the invisibility of Black experience in Nova Scotia, Canada, and beyond. She is a nationally recognized scholar, particularly in the area of diversity, systemic oppression, and inclusion. When I went online last night to see if I would print out a little bit of an introduction, I decided I didn't have a ream of paper there, so I would simply go with the concise edition. But I will note two things for you. Perhaps you know them already. First, Dr. Bernard is a member of the Order of Canada. And secondly, although many might not consider it equally as glowing a tribute, she is also recognized by the Elizabeth Fry Society as, and I love this phrasing, a person with a cause, a rebel with a cause. That's the word, a rebel with a cause. What a great award to receive. Juan, we're so pleased that you took time to come and speak to us this afternoon, and we welcome your remarks.
Thank you. So thank you all for coming, and thank you, Roger, for your intro. It's interesting, my niece, who lives in Bermuda, was doing a project for school, and she went online, and she was looking, I don't know what she was looking for, but somehow she found me, and she said to her mother, I think Aunt Wanda is famous. So I had to explain to her, no, I'm not famous, but I have been working in this field, in the field of social work for, my goodness, well over 35 years, 38, I think it's 38 years now. And it's a long time. So I'm glad you mentioned that Rebel with a Cause award, because I certainly have been a rebel and always with a cause. And that cause has always been around issues of equality and equity and human rights and so on. And one of the areas of work has really been around making some of the invisible history, some of our invisible stories, more visible. So I'm delighted that you're all here and that you're interested in this topic. So what I'm going to do with you today is share with you very briefly some background, and then I want to talk about Black women domestics. The term I use, Black women in service, is a term, not just my term, but a term that is used in the literature. And very little is known about Black Nova Scotian women domestics. Much of what's written in the literature about domestics speaks about domestics who came here from the Caribbean, mostly to Toronto and Montreal. But the Nova Scotian stories of domestic is very much invisible. And then I'll speak to some of the reforms that came about in the fields of human rights and community development, and some of that through their efforts, through the efforts of these women. Again, that invisible history. I'll talk a bit about the impact of social change on the Black domestics and their families, and then I'll wrap up with some discussion of the lessons learned about mothering, about other mothering, as told through the women themselves. So in terms of background, I'll very quickly run through this piece. We know that 1604 was the first known presence of African people in Nova Scotia, Matthew da Costa. And he was actually an interpreter between the First Nations people and the Mi'kmaq and the explorers. So that says that he had to be here before then to actually learn the language and be able to be that interpreter. But very little is known about him. Very little is taught about him in our Nova Scotian history. Jumping very quickly, sort of looking at the 18th and 19th century settlements and the movements of African Canadians here. So So we know that the Black Loyalists, the Maroons, the refugees, and then more recently the immigrants from the Caribbean and African countries. What we know is that there are 43 African Nova Scotian communities in Nova Scotia. Did you know that? 43. There are 43 Black communities in Nova Scotia, and they're all on the fringes of white towns and cities. And largely, when you think about the settlement, you know, African people didn't choose to come here originally. We came as escaped, you know, the Underground Railroad escaping slavery in the U.S., and some were slaves were bought and sold here in Nova Scotia. And people don't want to acknowledge that part of our history, but we have to. If we don't acknowledge the history and the mistakes in our history, we're likely to repeat those mistakes in the future. So we need to acknowledge that history. And so the settlement of these communities through the various routes that we've come, on the fringes of white towns and cities, really those communities did not have real access to services. But because they were on the fringes of white towns and cities, the men and women in those communities, quite frankly, served as cheap sources of labor. They were cheap sources of labor. So if you think about in Sydney, for example, we had the folks from Barbados who came to work in the steel plant. They helped to settle Whitney Pier. People love to talk about the wonderful integration of Whitney Pier. But if you look back at that history, the Black people were very separate. And we see, you know, the legacy of those settlements and a lot of the pain that we're seeing through cancer and the tar ponds. And, you know, the research really hasn't been done to really give us the full impact of that, but we know that that impact is there. So essentially we've helped, and the most visible story would be that of Africa. Separate and unequal. You know, they didn't have the same services. And this is history in our time. This is very recent history. And so when people are fighting for the rights that other people just take for granted, it's a bit frustrating. So people of African descent helped build the province, but have not received credit for that. And were not seen or treated as equal under the law. So I've already started talking a bit about some of what's happened in the 20th century. So we see the makings then of a very separate world for African citizens in this country. And although there's been a lot written about civil rights movement in the United States, and we take a lot of credit for that, we teach a lot more of that history than we teach of our own history. We haven't really talked about the civil rights movement that was happening right here in Nova Scotia. We did have the Nova Scotia Association for the Advancement of Colored People. They were fighting for rights. I already mentioned this geographic segregation. We also had legally segregated schools. Segregated schools were legal in Nova Scotia until 1954. And the only way that these 43 Black communities could get schools in their communities was if they created them themselves. And how do you create a school if you don't have money and resources? They had some help from the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, and later through the African United Baptist Association, to create schools so that people could become educated, because they knew the value of education. De facto segregation existed much longer, but legally segregation ended in 1954. Separate churches. We still say that 11 a.m. on Sunday is the most segregated hour in the world, likely. But separate churches happened because African people were not allowed to worship in the churches, in the white churches, in the towns and cities. And so they weren't allowed to worship in the main part of the sanctuary. They had to be in the balcony. But people resisted. You know, they said, this isn't right. If we're going to sit in the balcony here, why not have our own churches? So some of that history is available right here at Acadia Divinity College. any of those pieces, if you want more information on, you can certainly get those. Inadequate housing, lack of employment opportunities were commonplace in all of those 43 communities throughout the 20th century. And so then we have black women and working and opportunities for work. And very little, as I said earlier, very little is known about their experiences. And in this project, we look specifically at post-war Halifax. These findings are based on the research study conducted on black women at work, race, family, and community in Greater Halifax by myself and Dr. Judith Fingard. She is a historian at Dalhousie University. Some of you may know her, and former dean of graduate studies at Dal. And she and I did this piece of work. So what was the study? It was a qualitative study. We did interviews with 12 black women from the Eastern County area, and with those who were working post-war, World War II, from the 40s to the 50s. And we did a thematic analysis of those 12 interviews. So what were black women's experiences as domestics? What did we know? What we learned was they were the first generation of married women to engage in paid work outside the home on a regular basis. But remember, because of segregated schooling, they didn't have education. They didn't have that opportunity to engage in other types of employment. So this was the only employment available to them. Most of these women were very accepting of the opportunity to actually have work, at least initially. Who were the employers? Most of the employers were married working women. So again, we're talking about the first generation of white women to be working and married. And many of them were Jewish. So that was an interesting piece that we found from these women. That most of the women that employed them were Jewish women. So we were looking at women in greater Halifax area. So we had people from the cities of Halifax and Dartmouth, but also from the surrounding county areas. So those black communities of the Prestons, East Preston, North Preston, Cherrybrook, Lake Loon, Lucasville, Hammond's Plains. So these are the women. So on the fringes of Halifax as well. So what was interesting was we saw some differences in our analysis between those who lived in the city, so right in Halifax, Dartmouth, and those who lived on the fringes in those rural communities. The women who lived in the city wanted better opportunities because they knew that there were different opportunities. They had greater exposure. However, those who were living in the rural and the urban fringe communities, they had somewhat of a different attitudes towards work. First of all, they weren't that aware of other opportunities because they were pretty locked down in those segregated communities. And remember, there's no transportation. They're geographically isolated and separate. And so they didn't have to get into town. You either went on the back of a horse or back of a truck in the next generation, or you walked. Some of these women walked to work. And it's 10, 12, 14 miles to walk from where they lived to work in the homes that they were working in. So the opportunity to work as domestic was seen a little differently because for them it was an opportunity to get out of their homes, to get into the city, to have a little bit of, you know, there was a little bit of excitement, to meet different people. And I didn't share with you, one of the reasons why I actually did this study was because I was listening in on a conversation between my mother and some of her friends who were domestics. And as they were talking and laughing and sharing stories, I got a glimpse into what their experiences were like. And I wanted to learn more about it. And so this is how this study actually ended up happening, because I was eavesdropping on this conversation. And part of what the women were talking about was that one of the things they would do is they would gather. So in Dartmouth, the ones who worked on the Dartmouth side, they walked into work And then when they finished work, they would walk to the old ferry terminal, and you know that area. And that was one of the gathering places. And then that's where they would wait and meet and travel back home. So that's how they made that connection. So although they had some concerns about their employment, they didn't talk about those. The positives for them far outweighed the negatives that they were experiencing at that time. Okay? Through our research with these women, we also realized that the significance of the income really varied a lot. For some of the women, the income supplemented the family income. So maybe they were married to someone, to a man who had more steady employment. And so their income was extra. They could use it to buy those extra things for their children. But for some, it was the only source of income. Some of these women were widows. Some of them had never married. But so the income had very different meaning for them. The age of entry into the workforce and patterns of employment was another difference. So some of the women entered the workforce as soon as they finished school. And the segregated schools, I didn't mention this, I don't think, segregated schools only went to grade 8. To go beyond grade 8, you had to go into the city school and you had to pay. Most of those families could not afford to pay, and they had no transportation anyway to get their children there. So most of these women could not go to school beyond grade 8, even if they wanted to. And so for many of them, they would have gone to work at that point. Some of them, though, didn't go to work until much later. And some of the women in our study didn't go to work until their last children went to school. So some of them stayed home much later. Large families were certainly the norm. Everyone had a large family. When we're talking large, we're talking real large. You know, some of these women had as many as 18 children, all born to them. Not stepchildren, all born to them. To have 9 or 10 would have been considered a small family in those days. And the other thing was that many of these women, in addition to their own families, own children that they born, they informal adoption. They took in many children from the community, whether they be relatives, so maybe grandchildren or godchildren or nieces or nephews, or maybe just someone else, someone who couldn't care for their children. These women stepped in and provided that care. Any child in need could find a home in those days, and they did. And there were no rights. There were no employee rights. And so if a woman was in a situation where the work was unbearable, she would just quit. And many of them did. But they didn't treat me right, and I just got sick of it. I would just leave. And it was very easy to find another job. They would just maybe go to the next door neighbor and offer their services. And most of them actually got work through talking and being referred through each other. Most of the women that we interviewed actually talked about having very positive relationships with their employers. So for many of them, it was a very respectful relationship. I remember in one of the stories, one of the women talked about when she retired, she was given a check for $13,000. Now, she's the only one that had that kind of experience, mind you, one out of the 13. But another one talked very specifically about very generous employers, and unexpectedly. Like that $13,000 check was very unexpected. But every one of the women we interviewed talked about experiences of racism. And they were all tested in some way to ensure that they were honest. So there were things like $50 bills being left, maybe under the flour, the jar that had the flour or the peanut butter or something like that, put in a place where, you know, they knew they were being tested. And they were frequently tested in this way. Some of the women talked very painfully about experiences where they had to eat in the kitchen while the family had their meals in the main dining room. So that very separate. And some talked about having to use separate dishes. They weren't allowed to eat on the regular dishes. Some of you may have seen the film, The Help. Yes, some of you may have seen that film. And talking about experiences in the southern U.S. And it's supposedly fictional. Some of these women talked about things very similar to what those women talked about. So we see these varied experiences. We see the sort of very positive, very generous kinds of things that were happening, but we also see these very negative kind of testing and very negative. One of the stories that one of the women told was being at work and falling and breaking her leg, and the employer just not taking her to the hospital. And she had to phone, she had one daughter that had a vehicle. She had to phone her daughter to come and get her. It took hours for her daughter to come. That woman never actually walked properly again after that, because that break was unattended for so long. And, that's like, who would do that? But this happened. This is this woman's experience. And so you have that, and then you have the woman receiving a $13,000 check, So very much disparity in terms of the way people were treated. And there were no laws, no employment laws. There were no employment contracts. Just as the women could basically leave anytime they wanted to, they could also be fired at any time. If the employer was not happy with them, they could say, you're no longer, your services are no longer needed, or you're fired. And that happened. And you can imagine for the women for whom the money was just extra, that's no big deal, But for the women for whom the money was an absolute necessity, that would be a major deal. So were these women just sitting around and allowing these things to happen to them, or were they involved in that whole political civil rights movement? Many of them were involved in the civil rights movement. They weren't just sitting around letting things happen to them. They were very involved in participating in the reforms that were happening in human rights and community development of the day. And so some of them, the human rights scene was just happening during this time. And there was an advisory committee. Some of the women in our study, or their daughters, were part of that advisory committee. So they were activists in their own right. And there were three major areas for reform: employment, education, and housing. So one of the exciting things that happened was there were opportunities for continuing education, night school. Those teachers who were teaching in the segregated schools created opportunities for night school. Some of these women were the first students to participate in those night school programs, and they went back to school to upgrade their academic abilities. The reforms in employment. The NSAACP, one of the things that they were doing, here it is. The NSAACP had a program where they were looking at improving job prospects. So they were going into employers and sort of trying to create opportunities for employment for some of the women from these communities. And housing, really important cooperative housing program started during this time as well. And so here we saw really positive reforms and changes happening in terms of housing and then employment and the adult education, but also the education of the young people. I was one of those young people. I'm from East West. I was one of those young people who benefited from the kinds of activities that, my mothers and her colleagues, her peers, engaged in. Educational opportunities, what were we seeing? We saw huge changes, and actually myself and my sister and our cousin, we were the first three people from our community to go to university. to have that opportunity, the first three people. This was 1969. This is very recent history. 1969, we were the first three people to go to university. And so although we saw the end of legal segregation in schools in 1954, it wasn't until 1969, 1970, that we saw any significant numbers of African Nova Scotian children going on to post-secondary education. We were the first to go to university. There were a few that went on to vocational school, which is now a community college. But it was largely because of our mothers who were working as domestics, who were saying, we want something different for our children. We do not want our daughters to work on their knees. We want our daughters to use their brains. So there was a huge, huge expectation. You know, lots of young women and young men dream of following their parents into the workforce. Our mothers are saying, absolutely not. You are not doing this work. This is too hard. And you have too much potential. And they recognized their own potential. But they had these structural limitations. So they worked to change the structural limitations. They worked to make a difference there. So what was the impact? I'm getting ahead of my slides here. So I've just talked about that this work, especially the women in the rural communities, the opportunities to sort of to engage. I remember one of the women saying, her employer was saying, what's your daughter going to do? Is she going to be a secretary or something, that pink collar work? And this woman saying, I told her, no way, my daughter's going to be a nurse. Her daughter did become a nurse. Okay? So it gave them goals and aspirations, especially for their children. I've already mentioned that. The NSAACP used test cases to make changes in employment and other conditions. I remember, some of you may know the late Senator Calvin Muck. He tells the story of not being able to get a haircut in a barbershop in Dartmouth and taking his son with him to force the barbershop, to force them to make the change. Viola Desmond, that story. It was 1946, 9 years before Rosa Parks. But if you ask any student in school about Rosa Parks, they can tell you about Rosa Parks. And then you ask them about Viola Desmond, and they'll say, well, who was she? She was 9 years. Her civil action was 9 years before Rosa Parks, but no one talked about it. And it wasn't until 2010 that she received a pardon from the Nova Scotia government. That movie has been showing on Eastlake a lot, which is good. So I don't mind the fact that they're showing it over and over. I hope people watch it and watch it with your children. So who were these women? They were early feminists. They were feminists before the language of feminism. They were strong matriarchs in their families and communities. They weren't just concerned about their own children, they were concerned about community children. And they fought for the systemic changes and empowerment. So as these women passed the torch to their daughters, to my generation, they taught us to resist oppression, to fight oppression. They taught us to stand up. No wonder I became a rebel with a cause. I was learning it from the time I was born, I'm sure, how to be a rebel with a cause, because I could see it in my own family. The deferred dreams of the mothers influenced their children. The deferred dreams of these women influenced my generation. These mothers encouraged their daughters to break the glass ceiling. Don't accept any limitations. Don't let anyone put limitations on you, was the message we frequently heard. you can do anything. We saw service sector jobs opening up. I remember one of my sisters was the first person to work in a store in Dartmouth, my older sister, because there were no black people working in stores in Dartmouth. And that was because the NSAACP went and pushed and said, you need to create these opportunities. And then, as I've mentioned, the pathways to post-secondary jobs, creating those kind of opportunities. I wouldn't be where I am if those doors hadn't been pushed open. So these women saw the disparities. Health, wealth, happiness. You know, the American dream, the Canadian dream. These were not really options available to these women. So they knew that change had to happen. So what are some of the lessons learned? As I've already mentioned, these mothers taught their children to dream big. And that's quite a jump, if you can imagine, dreaming big from just a generation ago of not having any dreams, not being allowed to dream, not being allowed to go on beyond grade 8. I mean, I think about it today and I find it hard to even imagine what it had to be like for them. Our mothers modeled social activism in their fight for rights. So, in a sense, their work as domestics created some opportunities for them, because as they were going into these homes and they were working, and they worked hard, but they also noticed things. So they noticed books, and they noticed magazines, and they noticed who wasn't represented in those books and magazines. They had exposure to television. Most of these women had no TVs at home. They had no telephones at home. And so they noticed things and they thought, you know, if these things are available to these people, why are they not available to us? And so that's what drove them. That's what motivated them in this fight. But what was deeply entrenched in them, I think, were these values of hard work. I've already talked about that ethic of care. You take anybody in, you know. Anybody needed a home, they got a home. Anyone showed up at mealtime, they got a meal. Didn't matter if you didn't have quite enough for your own family. If a visitor came to your home, they were served, whatever was going. That helping tradition, that collective consciousness. Your problem is my problem. My problem is your problem. You know, if I have a burden and I take it to you, I know it's going to be. So those are the kinds of values they instilled, that they had and they instilled in us. And then the resistance, the fight for rights. Patricia Hill Collins writes about other mothers. I believe these women were the original other mothers. You know, they were the women who were stepping in, filling in the gap. When the birth mother couldn't do the job, for whatever reason, they stepped in to fill in the gap. They also lifted as they climbed. They weren't just concerned about their own life and their own transition and success. They were concerned about the whole communities. So they brought others along with them. So thinking about the future, looking towards the future, stress, hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, when I think about the impact of the systemic racism on the health and well-being of these women, I think it's painful to even think about it. But they didn't stay stuck there, they looked further. So I ask the question, where are we now? I ask the question often, are the lessons of the past lost on this, what I call microwave generation? We want everything instantly. This hip-hop generation, we want everything instantly. Have the more affluent children of these domestics made things too easy for their children. And what have we done as we pass it on? Are other mothers still available to those who need extra support? Are we still standing in the gap when a woman, when a mother can't do what needs to be done for her children? I believe that Black youth today still face far too many barriers. When I think about how hard these women, these Black domestics, worked to make change, and I look at the changes that have been made, and then I'm out there, I'm on the ground, I know what's happening today, and I'm thinking there are still far too many barriers. We haven't seen enough change. So what's wrong? What's wrong? I had a conversation with your president here at Acadia and his senior staff earlier this week, and we talked about the fact that Acadia is losing ground in terms of attracting African Nova Scotian students. You're in the heart of the valley. There are several Black communities here in the valley. Where are those students going? Why are they not choosing Acadia? And how many of them are having success in high school or not? There's still a gap here. Black women are still caught at the intersection of race and gender oppression. That oppression hasn't gone away. So we have more laws in place now. But the way oppression happens, it's actually so sophisticated now, it's hard to even name it. And nowadays, when you name some sort of oppression, you almost get labeled as a bit of a troublemaker, a rebel, maybe without a cause. So I ask the question, who's responsible for change, for making the future different, for the next generation? Who's responsible for this? Is it an individual responsibility, or is it an institutional responsibility? And I think in our society, we get too focused on the either or. I believe it's a both and. It's individual responsibility and institutional responsibility. We need the institutional changes, but we also need individuals to make sure they're ready to accept the kinds of changes that are coming as well. And individuals make up institutions, right? And so those individuals help make the changes that are needed. So when I think again towards the future, I ask the question, what impact has the changes of the 60s had on current conditions? Black women's roles in the change process have been hidden for the most part. So much of what's written about our history excludes the experiences of Black women. So part of our responsibility, I think, is to make their contributions more visible. And I think we need to make them visible to our young people. We need to make them visible to educators. We need to make them visible to politicians, to policymakers. You know, these are the people who can influence change, the kinds of changes that we need for the next generation. And if we don't do that, who will?